Ariel Dorfman, it's a great pleasure to have you here tonight. Before you and I speak, I think I would like us to listen to some music. If you can bring down the lights also.
That allows us to hear the second melody, which is the one that Schubert used for his lead.
Okay, excellent. No hay mal que por bien no venga.
No hay mal que por bien.
La, so la, la, la,
you want more of it?
La, la, la. No, it's all
no,
right.
No, but
it's, I think they should hear that part if they want to keep on doing it.
So continue for 10 seconds.
That's all right.
So even your reaction to this seems to me to imply just how meaningful this music is to you, because you immediately had regrets that we were turning the music off. This music is highly meaningful for you on many, many different levels. And perhaps we could start simply by asking you, what have we been listening to and why does it matter to you so deeply?
And then I will then, this is going to be one of my longer replies.
We'll see.
But first of all, I just want to say how very, very pleased I am to be here at the New York Public Library and in New York, which of course is one of my cities. Santiago is another one, and Buenos Aires is another, Amsterdam is another. I've got many cities, but this is one of them. You know, it's very important in that sense. So I probably heard Death and the Maiden for the first time in my parents' house somewhere in Queens. They had, you know, when I was perhaps 7, 8 years old or something like that, I was in Queens as a child. My father was working at UN. I had no idea, of course, what it was, but it sort of entered me in that sense. And it's been with me like many other melodies. Let me tell a couple of stories that happen in the book about music, okay? And why this in particular matters. So, in 1973, Allende was the president of Chile. I was cultural advisor to his chief of staff, and I was working at the Palace of La Moneda trying to stop a coup d'etat, which then did happen on September 11th of that year, 1973. In the midst of all the turmoil, where I thought that I would be killed and that I'd never see my family again and that my comrades and friends would all be slaughtered, I found the time to go to listen to a concert. The concert was a concert of all Beethoven quartets. And I thought that listening to this sort of a concert in the middle of the sense of civil war that was impending was a way of reclaiming the serenity of Beethoven and what Beethoven the idea, I mean, basically a revolution, a real revolution is where you want everybody to have the chance to listen to Beethoven, right? All of us together, right? The Ode to Joy is something real that is in the streets and among the people, and an ode to joy because there's not hunger and because there's not prostitution, because there's not child beating and women being set apart. I mean, all these things that one would hope would come out of social change.
And I recall clearly in a different context when bombs began to fall on London and Winston Churchill was advised to close the British Museum, the British Library. He said, we're fighting precisely to keep this institution open.
That is right. And you could say that the same thing has happened in the sense of, in some sense, I was fighting for Beethoven para todos, right? And not only Beethoven para todos, Beethoven que naciera desde todos. In other words, for the little Beethovens who were in the slums and who would die of hunger and never have a chance to ever, ever write the wonderful things that Beethoven wrote, right? So there's that sense also of a world where every child has the chance to become, if he or she so wishes, to become a Beethoven, right? So in these circumstances, I took off from my work as political advisor to the president and went off to a concert at this theater that was there. And as I sat in my seat, in the row in front of me, sort of like here, in comes the man, it's a man called Jaime Guzman, who was the eminence grise later of Pinochet, who wrote his constitution. And it was on television, a member of the Opus Dei. I won't go into many details about how detestable this man was, because afterwards he was assassinated by an extremist left-wing squad many, many years later. And
something you did not endorse. I mean, something
I didn't endorse, but believe me, I had murderous impulses towards him, right? No, I mean, you know, the book in great measure is the acceptance of who we are and all the complexity of who we are. So to think that I'm a saint up here, whoever reads the book will realize that I'm not. But so he was there, and they begin with this wonderful, it's very strange because they generally don't begin with the 15th, right, which is the culmination, I think, of classical music, the 15th quartet of Beethoven. And he began to sigh. Oh, like that. He loved it so much. And I thought to myself, I either strangle this man or I leave. Because I can't share with him this. Because this is the man who will then go into the streets and desire the death. And he probably broke open champagne. I doubt champagne because he was too much of an austerity freak, you know, to have any champagne. His only pleasures were to beat himself with a cilice, you know, cilicio, like this, in front of a figure of Christ. So it was said. He was really not the best sort of person. He's sort of the opposite of what I am. I'm full of pleasure-seeking, you know, out-extroverted. Anyway, so I left. Skip to 3 or 4 years later. I'm in Paris in exile, living the worst exile you can imagine. And I receive every week news from Chile that my mother-in-law sends me in little rolled-up sort of pieces of envelope and things like that. And I read in a magazine an interview with the general of the Air Force who created Gustavo Lee. He created, he did the coup d'etat with Pinochet. And he created the worst of all the intelligence services that refined the forms of torture. And in the interview, he says, they ask him, and what do you like to do? And he said, typically Nazi fashion, right? George Steiner speaks about this when he speaks about Auschwitz and the men who were in and out of, right? Where they went back home and they listened to the great classics of German music. And he says, I love Beethoven. And I love the quartets, you know? And I grabbed the magazine and I threw it down and I said, ¿Qué le va a gustar a este hijo de puta eso? You know, and I sort of almost stamped on it. That son of a bitch.
Do you need a translation? No.
That son of a bitch can't possibly want to. And I let it remain there. And slowly, I was in one of the 14th house that we had been in. We were living on borrowed places, which is much worse, right? Every place was borrowed. We were going from one place to another. We were absolutely penniless. We were working for the resistance. And the light in Paris began to come down, that beautiful crepuscular light that there is in Paris. And I looked down at this magazine and I thought to myself, and I think that's where we're coming now. That's why it's a long answer. I said to myself, it's much more interesting if he likes Beethoven than if he doesn't.
Because?
Because that makes him human. Because that means that I share Beethoven with him. And if I share Beethoven with him, it's very difficult to understand my relationship with him. Because otherwise, it's very easy to be for the death penalty, which I'm not. To say, let's eliminate him, right? Let's eliminate this specimen from the earth. And because that goes against my principles, but it's not the principles. I mean, we all have principles because you've got to live with your principles. And so to live with the principles meant in great measure to think about what that meant. That he, in effect, was it that he liked Beethoven like I like Beethoven? Did he sigh like that other man had sighed? Is it that? So what joined me to that man? And that is the very core of the beginning of Death and the Maiden, in which a man, a doctor, not necessarily a doctor, has tortured a woman. The woman thinks she recognizes his voice many, many years later. And one of the things...
Because she never saw him.
She never saw him. She was blindfolded in the dark, as most torture victims are. And there are many things that seem to be recognizable about this man. But the damning factor is that this man played Death and the Maiden to her. Now, when he played Death and the Maiden to her, it was to heal her, to seduce her. So the most wonderful music in the world was used to seduce a woman so she could be raped. And I think that's terrible. But you know what? That's real. In other words, and the fact that they shared that humanity, that what they shared in that darkness was the Schubert that
but
I love so
how
much.
How do you reclaim the Schubert that you love so much when it coexists with such horror?
In my case, I suppose that what I do is I write about it in some sense. In some sense, I try to understand. We're talking about the nature of evil here,
yeah,
and how you share a common territory with your enemy. Does that mean you don't fight that enemy? No. But it means that you enter that struggle in a different way. Because you're not, in a sense, you're not out to destroy the enemy as much as to destroy that in the enemy, which makes the enemy inhuman. So when I came to write Death and the Maiden, the play, I didn't go for the Beethoven. Because in my head was, la da da la la da la da da dee la da la 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 la. That song was in there somehow. And I somehow knew that Paulina, when she spoke to this man for the first time, would come to that moment when she spoke about Death and the Maiden. That was the moment. If you see any of the plays, you will see that it's exactly timed so that she dances somehow with that. So how does she reclaim it? You reclaim it. How does she reclaim it? She reclaims it because she has to ask herself if she's going to be like that man. That man could be innocent, by the way, the one she captures. But somebody tortured her, more than one person. The question is, how does she bring Death and the Maiden back into her life? How does she bring back the beauty and the love of beauty into a life that has been ravaged? And it's the question which, in fact, informs all my work. How can I write about beauty?
Particularly when that beauty has been, there's been a contamination.
It has been contaminated, yes.
I mean, so that several questions come to one's mind. One of them has to do simply with what it means about the power or the uselessness of art.
Well,
in
art,
some way,
yes.
The man who leaves a concert.
It can't stop him. In other words, Death and the Maiden cannot stop somebody from torturing. All right? This is a horrible thing to decide.
But yet we believe that these works
yet,
of art will in some way...
And yet, in some way, if we forget... In other words, music in particular, by the way, literature a little bit less, though Thomas Mann speaks about this very often... Music has a demonic quality to it. And therefore, it has the chance of bringing out into the sort of the open these impulses. Let's call it the deaf impulses, right? And it has the other this promise of paradise in it. It's very strange because it's related to the spheres. I mean, the Greeks were absolutely right about that, right? And the rhythms of the universe and the rhythm of the mathematics, it's all related to the harmony of the universe in some way, right? Even if there are neutrinos that are trying to go faster than the speed of light. But there's a sense in which you have to recognize the ambiguity of that literature. Literature cannot, I put it in the following phrase. Literature can't stop horrible things from happening, but it's because of literature and art and music, because we're here thinking in these terms, that the world is worth living, and it's worth fighting against those things and hoping for a world where those things won't happen, those terrible things. So a day may come when you will be able to sit down in any country in the world and listen to this, and there will not be a torturer, a tormentor, a child molester, a wife beater, an exploiter nearby. A day may come. Music asks us for that world because it has a democratic relationship with us.
So a day may come is a utopian wish?
But it's utopian only if it's unreal. I'm a utopian, but I'm a realistic utopian. Yeah, right. I mean, because I don't believe that in other words, I don't believe that just by thinking that something's going to happen, it's going to happen. On the contrary, I think that I think one of the great problems of the great utopians is that they went outward into society and very little into themselves. So you need to go into yourself as well and recognize in yourself that which is impeding you from becoming fully human.
And the book, in some way, is that journey inwards, looking back at an older self. We'll talk to some extent about, in a minute from now, about the structure of the book,
yes,
which I think is extremely compelling. You have a narrative that moves forward, and the inclusion in that book of a diary which is 20 years older than the
yes,
book.
Yes.
But before we get to that, I yes, asked you to send me a biography.
Well, seven words, you said.
Yes, I said seven words.
And I made a joke. I said it's like Haydn because of the seven last words on the cross.
It
right,
is.
Which are this cantata of Haydn.
Yes, and these are not your seven last words.
I
want to read them and maybe have
yes,
you comment on it.
Yes.
Since I don't particularly care or enjoy the notion of reading the biography of a writer, because you all know why you're here and you can all find out who Ariel Dorfman is if you don't know, and I think it's worthwhile reading the book to find out much more. But here you gave me, a biography in
a haiku.
As we might say today, a tweet in seven words, and you did it in two languages. You did it first in English, where you said, exiles, homecoming, we're salvation, justice, literature, compassion, and you called that the wanderer's haiku, or you said haiku dell'eterno caminante,
right,
exilios, homecomings, qual salvación, justicia, literature, compasión.
Right.
So
I like the Spanish because it rhymes.
Yeah, it does.
Salvación, compasión. So yeah, so I was trying to think, I mean, I'd never been asked to give a sort of a bio intro in seven words. So I thought, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do, but that was 10 words, you know. So I thought, no, this is not going to work. And then I began thinking of the haiku structure, of the idea of doing two, and then two, and then three, right? Like that. It's not quite a haiku, but... So I thought of myself as give it to me so I can read it again.
Yes,
so I can give it out. So it would go, the wanderer's haiku would be, exiles, homecomings, where's salvation? That's a bit of I cheated a bit there because the where's salvation. But, you know, English allows it. Justice, literature, compassion. So, haiku del eterno caminante, exilios, homecomings. I put that in English on purpose because it would have to have been in Spanish, retornos. retorno al hogar. I mean, it wouldn't have worked. So homecomings is one word. ¿Cuál salvación, o qué salvación it could be as well, the where salvation, justicia, literature, compasión. I love the fact that these words that I've chosen, in fact, are almost identical in English and as in Spanish. So people mostly would understand them in both languages, which is one of the characteristics. I have all these novels that I've called only with a word that can translate into every language, including Japanese and Chinese and Albanian. So you have the same word, mascara, confidence. I like the idea of a traveling title, a title that means different things in different languages.
And the title of this book, the title of this book is quite revealing in many ways, and I'd love you to both explain the title itself and the subtitle.
Yes.
I'm nearly more interested in the subtitle than I am in the title, though we'll get to the title in a minute because it also...
You want to start with the title?
Yeah, I'll start with the title.
Yes.
Feeding on dreams. And for those of you who may not know where it comes from, you actually have it in...
I put it there.
You put it there. I know how men in exile feed on dreams. And that's from Aeschylus.
That's from Aeschylus.
Interestingly enough, you leave out what comes right after, which is, I know how men in exile feed on dreams, and no such food is vain.
Yeah.
Why the omission?
Because they're confessions of an unrepentant exile.
Okay, so...
If there's a confession of a repenting exile, I would have put, and no such food to be vain, right?
Right. But why? What does it mean, unrepentant exile? Because the word repentant, to my mind, immediately means guilt, immediately means a religious context.
Let me begin by saying that this was a thing we discussed at great length with my wonderful editor who's here, Deanne Ermey, and if it hadn't been for her, this would be no book. So I don't expect you to make her blush by applauding for her, but I applaud her in my heart, and I thank her. And so we discussed at great length this, you know, and it took us a while to find that this was, in fact. In Spanish, it's called Entre Sueños y Traidores.
Between dreams and...
Between dreams, between sueños y traidores and traitors.
Betrayers
almost, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Y traidores, which is a very strong word. Un striptease del exilio, a striptease of exile. And I like to use the idea of an English word in the middle of the Spanish text, which is something, anyway.
Again,
Just to explain. So I think that the idea of the feeding on dreams came from a sense that we have to continue dreaming no matter what. And the idea of leaving the second part of the Aeschylus out was because how very strange. I haven't ever thought of this. I mean, you know, things just come to you and you but thinking about it, I have many regrets. In other words, I wouldn't want to live this life over in the way it was lived because there's too much pain in it. And much of the pain is not only mine, but it belongs to other people. And one can choose one's pain, but to choose others' pain as something inevitable is I think, wrong, right? I just don't think you can do that. However, given the inevitability of that anguish, of the uprooting from home, of the moving across borders, of the destruction of the homeland and of the dreams, given that, the question is, what do you do with that material? What do you do with what was handed to you, right? How do you transform it? But in a sense, I think that if you look at this carefully, you will think, I hope the reader finds, that it was inevitable. Everything I did...
You believe that?
Yeah. In other words, it ends up that given my personality, given my guilt and my problems, given the obsessions I had, given where I was coming from, given the life of wandering I had before, given the loves I have and the love for justice, and given my own failings, I don't think that any of the major things that happened here I could have avoided. I could have done them in any other way. I don't like necessarily what I did. There is in the very middle of the book a story of my own betrayal of people that I love. Hmm. And it's a very hard thing to write, you know. And there was more of that, by the way, and I took some of it out because some of my dearest and closest friends, including Deanne, including my agent, Gino, you know, and including my wife, who is my major reader and who's the secret protagonist or not-so-secret protagonist of the book, Angelica, said, don't be so hard on yourself. Why are you always so hard on yourself? Why do you... don't flagellate yourself. And I took out a lot that was much darker even in the book because I think it was too much.
So there is the essence of not repenting.
It's not repenting.
It's not repenting because it's inevitable.
It's not only is it inevitable, but because I think that the result is a human being who is a better human being, who is a more compassionate human being, and who is able to return some of the love that he received from the world to that world. And I think a great deal of the beauty that I received from the world, you know? So the fact that my life ended up here in this chair with you at this wonderful library, right?
Which honored you at some point
as a literary lion, right.
Some years
right.
back.
Right. So I mean that, but I'm here where all my books are here, but all the books that I love in the universe are here. And all the books that I won't read in the universe will be here, right? And every one of you has in your head all these books that I may or may not have read, you know? And all that, I can't repent of that. Right?
And I think the cover is fantastic in that
regard.
Well, thank
you. That was,
you know,
yes, that was
where
taken.
Was this taken?
That was taken in 1964, in fact.
You're looking
on
good.
On the 5th of September of 1964. And here's the story behind that is very, I was younger then. In some sense, I'm much younger now than I was then.
Oh.
Certainly, he was a wonderful and foolish
the
young
man.
The man on the cover.
Whoever
he was, you know, there. And Allende had just lost an election that he was going to win 6 years later. And I had grown a beard, sort of like a fledgling Che Guevara, you know, a beard like that. And I had bet with a Christian Democrat friend that I had bet that Allende was going to win this election in 1964, and he had bet that Frei, who did win the election, was going to be the president of Chile. And I thought I had a much better chance. I was wrong, you know. And in Heading South, Looking North, which is the sort of prequel to this, I speak about how the days before that I'd been in Allende's house working with the Allende's daughters, both of whom were dear friends of mine. And I had said to my Christian Democrat friend, he said, if Frei loses, I will jump naked, brain like a donkey, into the pool in front of La Moneda. This is a very, very circumspect. If I had jumped in brain like a donkey, nude, nobody would be surprised because I was a total nudist. I mean, a show-off, an exhibitionist. I have no problem, you know. But he, who probably had never taken his he was like the leopard in the Gato Pardo, right? He probably made love in the dark, not to show anything. For him to do this, he had to be very sure he was going to win, right? And I said, okay, I'll shave off my beard. And I won't have my beard on. I won't leave another beard on until there's socialism in all of Latin America if we lose. My chances of growing another beard are very remote, to put it mildly. He has not yet jumped into that pool. So before doing this, before cutting off my beard that day on the 5th of September of 1964, they took a picture of me in the backyard of my house, my parents' house, where I was still living at that point, and which then demolished after the coup. And I speak about what it
you
meant
do.
For the house of my dreams to be demolished and to come there and to see just
very moving, there. Moving passage.
Yeah, and I go back there with a film crew many, many years later, and I describe what it is to find the back wall. This is the house. The house is like here, and this is the backyard. And the backyard goes to a little orange grove, a very, very back there. It's a beautiful, beautiful house with a garden. And there was a wall there. When we came back with the crew, and I was in tears because I'd never gone into this house. They built a six-story apartment building on top of it, you know, like, blah, on top of it. And that's what exile does. You come back home and you find that there is no home. You can't go home. And I touched the wall, and the wall was the same wall. The architects had left that wall there for some strange reason. And so I recognized the wall. The wall greeted me in some sense. The book's all about that, about being greeted by things you recognize and things that you can't help.
But earlier on, just a few minutes ago, you said something that touches me quite deeply, which is the notion that you're in this library now and you talk about your library at some great extent in this memoir. And you speak about your work in the context of world literature.
Yes.
And it reminded me of a passage that Edwidge Danticat mentions in Create Dangerously, where she quotes Daniela Farrière, who writes in a book called I'm a Japanese Writer, Flaubert, Goethe, Whitman, Shakespeare, Lope de Vega, Cervantes, Kipling, Senghor, Césaire, Roumain, Amado, Diderot. They all lived in the same village that I did. Otherwise, what were they doing in my room?
Yes, yes.
And Danticat asks, if there is a border between Antigone's desire to bury her brother and the Haitian mother of 1964, who desperately wants to take her dead son's body out of the street to give him a proper burial, knowing that if she does this, she too may die. So perhaps after those executions, when those young men and women were reading Caligula, Albert Camus became a Haitian writer. When they were reading Oedipus, yes. Rex and Antigone of Sophocles, they also became a Haitian writer.
Correct.
And this, in some way, seems close to your universe.
Absolutely. And I speak of the following in this, because clearly you live in your library, you live with all the people all the writers who you've ever read are inside you. And the wonderful thing is that we share this space, right? Because if you say Goethe, then perhaps half of the people here who have read something of Goethe, and therefore that resonates with something of Goethe, or maybe they even just know about Faust and Mephistopheles and things like that, right? But you read, and the experience of exile allows you to meet many of these writers. At the same time, it allows you the following. I come back to Chile, and I pick up Antigone. I pick up Sophocles. Now,
As an older man.
So, what has happened in between the young man who at 16 or 17 or 15 read Antigone for the first time, then went into exile? What happened to this man? What happens is that, of course, when I read it first, I was reading a Greek tragedy that had a great resonance in me humanly, right? But then there are the disappeared. And I read a novel called Widows about women who find dead bodies and who are not allowed to bury them, and the dead bodies keep on piling up one, yes, after the other after the other. So I say, in this memoir, I say, what does it mean that I can go to see the mothers of the disappeared in Santiago and then come back to my library to read Antigone? It's a different Antigone. It's not the same Antigone. Because I am Antigone now. Now I know what that comes from. I know where Sophocles brought that from. He brought that out of the suffering that he saw in his days. He has to have seen all those. He has to have seen the mothers who never. Of course, it comes from mythology. But the reality of it, the pain of it, has to come from all the wars that were happening, the Peloponnesian Wars and the Persian Wars and all these wars that were happening, right? All the dead who were never buried. All those, right? So, and I say the same thing about Dante. I say, you know, Dante has the idea that the bread of exile. Of course, it has to do with the fact that the bread in Florence was of a certain sort with the salt or without the salt, right? And then he always missed that. So I understand what Dante is saying when I come back to Chile, when I'm in exile, in a very different way than if I hadn't gone through that. So that the suffering I went through and the experiences I went through of hope as well and of glory expand my universe so that village that Edwige speaks about through Dani, right? That this village becomes a village which is populated with much more significance in each case. Another strange thing that happens is that almost all the writers that I have in my library in Chile, when I recuperated, it's a long story that I won't go into, there are many writers that are there that I had read. And when I come back, most of the living writers I had met by then. So it's a very strange experience to think, oh, Now I know this person personally, and I've spent 17 years, or even more at times, meeting all of them, right? Because it's become a village in the sense also it's a village of my friends, of those I have met and who have changed me and have made me into a different sort of a person. Because every book you read resonates and expands you and makes you into a more human person.
So the relationship between being a reader of a certain kind and exile is what?
Well, look, every experience of reading is an experience of exile. Every experience is an experience of going into something and then losing it, you know, distancing yourself from it. And you don't really see it until you've finished it, and then you're out of the book, you're excluded. In some sense, you have to go back and forth. So it's like a country, right? And I think the go-between, the past is a foreign country, people do things differently. You could say that a novel is a foreign country, people do things differently, or they do things the same way there, right? You go in and out in that sense. So there's that sense of, but
of being alone also,
right?
Of deep solitude.
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, it's wonderful how communal and solitary both reading and writing are.
And I've always thought about that very much in terms of bringing, you said you've met the writers who populate your library in Chile, and I bring those writers I very much admire here.
Yes.
And I always wonder to what extent that experience changes.
Changes you mean?
Well, to some extent.
I mean, how changed is it that you've now met me? Because when we met for a very briefly,
very
when
brief
Widows
moment.
Was up at Williamstown,
yes.
Right?
Very briefly.
But that wasn't like this.
No, it wasn't like that at all.
And I wasn't that person, and you weren't that person.
I wasn't that person either. Right.
And you weren't those people either.
And none of this was. And, right. And when I begin to think about...
So how has it changed?
Well, you know...
How has it changed that you've met? Is the person that you meet... The person who's there, does it recall
well,
you in some sense?
Yes and no. To some extent, if you were the person who is in that book, I wouldn't need to read that book.
So I'm you would just package me.
No, and I'm greatly...
And pieces of me could go off to the world, right?
I'm sure they can, but that's not the point.
I hope not.
No, and so the part of it is precisely the idea that the person you meet is only a part of that person's, the landscape of their imagination. It's
yes.
much broader.
It
and it's also, to some extent, it can be a frightening experience because to some extent you want to create, you want to keep the mystery, though I'm always much more curious in not demystifying, but in
keeping the mystery.
Yeah, but in yes. also seeing who is this man named
yes.
Ariel Dorfman.
Yes.
Where does Ariel Dorfman come from?
Yeah, well, I mean, the book tells it at a point, but,
yeah.
you know, Peggy Atwood, Margaret Atwood says that we write to hide ourselves, not to show ourselves, you know, and I believe that's partly true. So, you know, it's like a preemptive act against the world. By the way, I really disagree with preemptive acts in general, especially when they're against foreign countries. But as a writer,
I see what you mean.
You create sort of barriers in the sense that you say, look, this is the version that I want of myself, of this contradictory, and there are things I will hide, and things that you won't know about, and there may be a third volume, what I think will be called Seven Sicknesses, in which I think I will speak about everything that I don't speak about here.
Seven.
I like the seven words, but the seven sicknesses came before, alas,
true.
Your provocation. There was a sense in which, but I think that I write the book, in a sense, it's apologia pro vita sua, you know, it's the idea of something which is, you're justifying, St. Augustine is the first one who does confessions, after all, he's the one who creates that idea of the autobiography as a confession, and where he establishes that one must tell the truth about who one was or you will never understand who one ends up being, right? So the idea of creating, and that takes us to the structure, which I think is a good question. How do I create
a
story?
Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah, no, it's very important because
it is.
Very rarely do people speak. I mean, this is
but
a work
very
of literature,
important.
Right?
It's very important.
You create a structure and you create a story which allows... not only the content of what's happening, but the very act of reading, the act of how the story develops, right? I mean, if you tell the story, a man goes to Dublin and somebody who could be his father but isn't sort of finds him. Well, that's Ulysses, right? But that's not exactly our experience of Joyce. So we say, this is the story of a man who leaves Chile as a revolutionary and ends up in a human rights activist. That's not really the story. I mean, so the experience of the reading has got to be, I hope, as good as the story itself is being told. It is the story that's being told in some sense.
So
and the most difficult thing was to find
about
that structure.
Well, talk a little bit about the structure, because as I said, as I alluded, you have these... It isn't really two narratives that are going on. It's one that is a looking back and one which is...
Well, it's...
Is old, is found in some way, is 20 years old.
Yeah.
The diary of...
Yeah. This is, I mean... Let me explain the problem I had. When I wrote Heading South, Looking North, which is the first book of these, right? First of all, I thought it would be very easy, and it turned out to be horribly difficult. So when I came to this one, I thought, this is really going to be easy because I know exactly, because also I've spent the last 20, 30, 40 years writing about this. So I know what happened. You know, I don't have to figure it out. I know the voice. The voice is the same voice of Heading South, Looking North. It isn't a different voice. I have my voice already. So I thought this is going to be, you know, and so I began by saying this should be done chronologically. It should be done, you know, I leave Chile. It starts then when I leave Chile. And I go through all the horrible experiences of Paris. Then I go to Amsterdam. Then I go to Washington. I end up in the States, which I don't want to be there, and then I go to Chile, and I have all the problems there, and I go back and forth. Then I go to 1990 to Chile, and I find out that that is not going to work because of Death and the Maiden, and then I come, and I'm very successful, and so that's the story. That's the trajectory of it all, okay? So I tried to write it like that, and it didn't work. And my wife keeps on telling me. I was speaking with Deanne Ermey today at lunch. She's saying, that's how you should have written. I said, no, it can't be written like that. First of all, the experience of the exile, in other words, the experience we have, exile and life occurs in the mind all the time. The past only exists in as much as we remember certain things. We go back and forth in time, right?
Quite literally remembering.
Quite literally remembering.
Putting the members back together,
right? You member it together. So when they speak in Ebonics, they say member, they're absolutely right. They're going back to the Latin, and but that's a different story. Anyway, so my problem here was, and there were three different drafts of this finally. My problem was, what is the central event that constructs the book? In other words, what is the book about finally? What is it about that the structure will give you? And there's got to be something that anchors this book in the middle. In the case of Heading South, Looking North, that was not a difficult decision. It was the fact that during 2 months in Chile, I was hunted and I should have died and I didn't. Okay? So that structure, narrated in the present tense, not in a diary, goes through the book one by one by one, right? And in alternate chapters, there is the story of my ancestors, my birth, and how I go. So here's the story. That while in the story of why I'm hunted to death and leave Chile, the story of my exile from Chile is happening, simultaneously, the young and little tiny Ariel Dorfman is growing towards Chile. But the reader already knows that I've lost it. He already knows this. So there's an ironic look at the past which allows the reader to share this experience of going back and forth. So you don't, in other words, you live life, when you live life, you don't know what's going to happen to you. You have to have a part where you don't know what's going to happen. Like a murder mystery, which I love, you know, I love suspense.
I know.
Thrillers.
So it's kind of retrospective illumination in
Correct.
Some way.
So what did I do here? Again, helped by my editor, you know, in that sense, and helped my agent, and helped by Angelica. I thought about this, and I thought, what is the central event that marks the difference in my life? What is the event that turned out entirely different from what I expected it to be? And what instruments do I have for this? And I said, well, I wrote a diary when I was in Chile in 1990. when after 7 years of dictatorship, I returned to Chile to go and settle down forever. And the diary tells the story, and a great part of it is quite textual, though a lot of it is reinvented and rethought, but it's really taken from that moment, in which through 6 months, in little flashes, I tell the story of how I go back to Chile and slowly disenchantment with the country comes in, and then I begin to write Death and the Maiden, and as I do this, I begin to reveal that I've changed too much. And while then I am losing the country through the other, in the other sequences from today, I'm writing about how I keep on trying to go back, trying to go back, trying to go back. So strangely enough, I was able to repeat the same structure, the same wrenching experience for myself and the reader that I had done in the first one, which I didn't think was possible. Because everyone was telling me, you've written... I won't say the words that people keep on saying about this, the first book, but they keep on saying, this is the book, et cetera, et cetera. And then I was saying, how are you gonna get a better book than the first one? And I said, I don't want a better one. I just want a book which will allow me to tell this story and to tell the story of the wonderful people who saved me and helped me to survive.
I'd love the audience here to get a sense of your prose. And I'd love you to read a short passage at the very beginning of the book, and I have marked it here for your ease.
Absolutely. And thank you very much. All right.
Here it is.
This is the first time I read from this book, so
it's also the first time you speak about this.
It's the first time. I've given a couple of very short interviews, but none like this. This is different. This is really talking about it.
Oh, you might want to you might want to contextualize it.
Well, this is the first of the excerpts from the diary, which is Diary of My Return to Chile 1990 on July 21st. So I begin by saying, all I ever wanted was to come home, which in fact probably will return as last echoing later. So I'm speaking about the fact that one of the things that I miss so much about Chile were the mountains. And I'm now sitting in my study in Chile after 17 years of exile, able to look at the mountains that mean so much to me. And before that, of course, I've explained how the mountains were protecting you and orienting you and what it meant to lose them. As my days of banishment turned into months and the months into years, I learned to control the vertigo of dislodgement, pretended that I could live without the mountains. That's what exile does to you. Like the dwindling away of a love you held dearest and swore you'd never survive. And then one day you find yourself drinking wine with someone else. You find yourself walking down a foreign boulevard and there's not a twinge of regret. You can live away from the mountain, you tell yourself. Except you can't. Except you watch what happens to your son. The mountains also began to disappear from my Rodrigo's drawings. This is my eldest son. No small event, this. Ask any child from Chile to sketch something, anything at all. Before any human figure, a cloud, a tree, they'll fill the upper space with an array of jagged peaks. So when the zigzag mountaintops began to wane from the pictures of our exiled sons and daughters, we took it as a warning from the very earth of Chile to beware. Cuidado. The country was receding from their eyes and perhaps from ours. And that's a very painful thing. So how do you keep the country, right?
And in my case... And when it disappears also from your children.
From your children, right.
From their imagination.
So I would read... I'd say later how I would read to Rodrigo adventure stories of Sandokan from Emilio Salgari in Spanish. He's Italian, right? And he would read one page, I would read one page, and we would continue like this so that he would not lose his Spanish. So, you know,
the language is also the anchor, it's the homeland in some way.
But, you know, I just want to mention this. I don't know if you've noticed how full of joy I am. And the book is very full of humor as well.
I hope you have noticed.
No, I'm just saying this because people tend to be very surprised at that I'm not very somber and sort of like this, you know, and not at all.
You mean because you write about death and torture?
But I didn't choose to have so many of my friends tortured. I didn't choose to have the president betrayed. I didn't choose to be in a world in which, you know, countries are invaded and people are bombed from afar and I didn't choose that. The world chose that. I just chose to make something better of that. And there's a part in the book in which I speak about how difficult it was to find joy, to not blame myself for enjoying something. And I speak out a very special moment when I begin to sing Mozart as I bike up the canals of Amsterdam. And I sing from Le Nozze di Figaro. Io sono dal contento, pieno di gioia il cor. Which, of course, is already strange because the person who's doing that is the Conde Almaviva, who's about, you know, to screw half of the women in his entourage. But exile brings
joy,
you a lot of other joys as well among those, right? So, but what I'm trying to say is I was filled with joy. And how do you steal joy? It's the first question you asked me, right? How do you steal joy from the torturer?
And how do you write joy?
How do you write that joy?
I think very few writers are able to write joy. Joy is a very hard thing to write.
Yes, it's strange. You know, in the latest issue, the fiction issue of the Atlantic, they put it the lead story, and they said they liked it so much because it was a story of a love story. And a love story which, with all its darkness, I can't write without having dark stuff in it, you know, was a very, very funny story about a man who is a copy editor in Italy and who finally, he's a very bad writer, and he finally writes, for Vanity Press, he writes a book. And he writes a book, but the only real good chapter he writes is about how he made love to a woman who then became a nun. So he realizes that this woman will, and it's the only thing that keeping him, the only pure thing in his life that keeps his life intact is this act of love that he had. Because before that, he had made love to the woman's mother and her sister when they drowned in a lake. So this guy is really, he has all this darkness in him. And what's nice about
it's quite
it...
quite a story.
That's just the preamble. And what I like about the story is then he realizes, he says, oh my gosh, there are 1,000 copies out there. She's going to read it. And he goes and he tries to retrieve every copy of the book so she won't read it. And he has to go through hell to get every copy back. Now, how it ends, read the story. But what I mean is, that story is one which I just felt such joy writing it. And you know why I could write that story? Because I wrote this. Because in some sense, I liberated myself from so many demons.
And you say this in the book. You say that this in some way was a liberation. This book freed you.
Yeah, I mean, I spent the summer writing stories about a couple who goes down a roller coaster in Disneyland. They take a photograph, and the photograph is shredded because there was a boy making an obscene gesture behind them. Then they go down again, and then there's an obscene gesture again. I mean, again, so I've just enjoyed myself enormously this summer because I finished...
It's all right.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I think it's really good.
No, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's wonderful. I feel this enormous liberation because now all you guys can be anguished with what I lived through. You know, I lived through it. Not only did I have to live through it, but as my wife said, now I've got to read it in Spanish and English in this version, the next version, over and over again. I don't have to read it anymore, except, of course, when you choose a
passage.
Or passage in other libraries where I'll be across the country reading in libraries primarily.
But to come back to the book, there's some extraordinary encounters. Maybe you want to choose some of them. But the encounter with Timmermann, the encounter with Günter Grass, the encounter with Kundera, the non-encounter with Jean-Paul Sartre.
I can tell. And choose whichever one. Let's start with, let's put them in order.
Yes.
Right?
Well, so Timmermann is extremely interesting, right. To some extent, to contextualize some of them, is an older self, namely yourself now, yes, looking back at some of the errors. As you say,
yes,
this is a very candid book in these ways. It tries to speak maybe of those figures who, I mean, in the case of Sartre, for sure,
yes,
but in the case of Kundera, who wasn't yet known, in the case of Günter Grass, who was very well known,
or Cortázar, Berl, who was in the middle
of this.
Or Berl, these are les grandes figures,
the
absolutely
great intellectuals,
right,
the people that... The God that failed, to some extent, also.
Yes, these are the major figures. These are the people I've been reading for years, and all of a sudden I'm with them. So, just to explain, probably many of you are aware of my op-eds and the commentaries that I write, in the sense that what I tend to do is I take an act, something that would seem to have no relationship whatsoever to what I'm going to talk about, and then I expand it into an understanding of the whole world. And what I try to do in each of these encounters, because, you know, again, when you're going to tell a life, the life that you tell could be as long as your life, which would mean like a Bordic historian, which somebody, by the time they finish narrating their life, they would already have another life to narrate, right? It would be eternal, right? As we could call it a biography of Babel, right? In that sense. So that's a good idea for a story. I'll try that. That'll be my next one. I'll go and write it tonight at the hotel. No.
Just let people know where the origin and the inspiration came from, right here.
The La Biblioteca de Babel.
Right here.
Yeah. The library. I will put Fort Paul and the New York Library.
It sounds perfect to me.
I will do that. Believe me, I will do it.
I know. I will try to retrieve every copy. Go ahead.
No. You must try to get everybody to read a copy. Exactly. This is a homage to you. Oh, so each one of these incidents is used to illustrate something deeper that is happening, right? Because it's as if there's a sea of experience, and then a submarine or an island comes out. You perch on the island like a bird, right? You pick every fruit that's there, and then you go to the next one, right? So that the island, or you plant seeds. But what I mean is, you create a situation where that island, that encounter, is meaningful. This is a book. Again, today I was speaking about this. This is a book that could have been full of celebrities and gossip, because after Death and the Maiden, I met all the stars. I did all the things I could have filled them with little gossip things, and it would have been a much more of a bestseller than it probably will be. I don't know what it will sell, you know, whatever
it
does.
Don't say what it will be.
I'm saying, but that's not the point. The point is, I wish it would happen. As I said today, you know, Umberto Eco once told me, he said on a program we were together, and he quoted Stendhal, and he said, "What I want is to be bought by all and read by the select few." And so... So that would be the desire. But that's the book. The book is so what I'm trying to say is that the structure of the book is also about the fact that you take an incident and you use it to meditate on what is being said to you at the moment, even if you don't quite understand it.
Especially if you don't, to some extent, taking Timmermans' story or Grass, happened at those moments were not quite... You were not old enough in some sense, or experienced enough.
But they make you mature. In other words, if they stick in your memory, it's because they were very important, because they stayed with me. In other words, everything that I met of each of these people stayed with me. And then later, years later, I say, now I understand what they were saying. Now I understand what they meant.
That's why it's important to meet them, but that's the same thing with reading. It's important to read Antigone's before we have lived what
you
it
have
means.
To. Yeah. You you have to, because otherwise it doesn't mean anything, right?
Right.
I mean, how are you going to accumulate the experience unless you don't understand? You have to not understand something so that later on it can fertilize you, and then you come to understand it, because then other writers will come, other experiences will come, and they will... And wisdom will come, we hope, you know, where you look back and you say, oh, so that's what it meant. And then you go back and you read Anna Karenina again, you know, and then you say, aha, so this is what it was about. It wasn't about what I thought it was about. It's not about adultery. It's about something different. Anyway, so a few of these incidents. So Timmerman, this is, and they all happen in sort of different lands. So Timmerman, the great Jacobo Timmerman, who at that point was the editor of La Opinión, the major newspaper in Buenos Aires, and they had given me a very big prize. So he calls me in the first day of my exile when I'm in Argentina, and I go there to his office, and he's going to offer me some money from the prize, more money than I got, so that I can live. A very generous man, but he doesn't tell me this until he says, listen, I would like you to write 4 articles at $1,000 each. For me, that was a fortune. We could have lived with Angelic and Rodrigo, you know, for months on this. But I want you to tell me what happened in the Argentine embassy during the 2 months that you were inside that embassy. What happened there? Interesting things must have happened. And I said, I can't do that. Because some of the interesting things that happened were so terrible and so horrible and so such a betrayal of the pure image that I want to do that this will be used against us. So I can't do that.
And the us being
us
who?
Being the resistance. In other words, you don't tell the dirty, you don't air the dirty linen of the revolution when the revolution has just been defeated, right? Or do you? The question is, what is the right moment to tell the truth about something? So I decided that politically, it was absolutely wrong for me to tell stories that could be used as ammunition against the major battle, which was the battle against fascism or neo-fascism in Chile, right? I mean, it's like the following. Well, Vercors does it in some sense, you know, in Les Silences de la Mer, right? But during the Nazi occupation of France, how are you to write a story in which you look at the Nazi occupier with some sympathy, for instance, right? Sympathy in the sense of saying he's a human being, right? It's the same problem I have with the quartets, right? Ese hijo de puta, right? And then I say, no, wait a second. So
that's just one moment in the dialectic.
Right, exactly. So I tell Timmerman that. And then I years later, I realize when I'm writing Death and the Maiden, and they say to me, this is not the moment to write this sort of thing. I say, no, this is the moment to write this sort of thing. When they say, the transition is so delicate. It's so difficult at this moment. Don't create trouble for us. We already have trouble. Pinochet's still commander-in-chief of the army. They still have a veto power in the Senate and the Chamber of Deputies. They still have the Supreme Court on their side. They still have the army. Pinochet is threatening to have a coup any day now. And you're going to put this play on? You're crazy. It's not the right moment. And I answer with my friend Jacobo Timmerman in some sense. I say, if not now, when? Now's the moment, you know? So I change in that sense. And strangely enough, something similar happens with Günter Grass, but on the political front. So I go to meet Günter Grass at his house in Hamburg, conveyed there by my German editor, Freimut Duwe, of Rowald at that point. And it was to enlist him for a series of cultural initiatives that we were having to help Chilean artists inside, you know, to get money to them so they could stay inside the country and not go into exile, not be like I was. And Grass is very happy and very good, and he's cooking this wonderful stew, and he's a great, great cook, you know. It's that, and next to the river, where the flounder comes from and all these things, you know. And it was just a wonderful conversation and things like that. And Angelica is with me, and she's ravishing and beautiful, and there's this wonderful dog that's there, and everything's going well. And then all of a sudden, Grass says, you know, I'm very, very upset with the fact that Chilean socialists did not come to a meeting for the Prague Spring. This is 1975. In the south of France, I'd just been there. So he had, and they didn't come. They said it was inconvenient. And I said to him, look, the point is, we couldn't go there, you know? And I said, I personally am for the Prague Spring, as President Allende was himself, but our allies are the communists. And we cannot destroy our coalition in order to help the Prague Spring, you know? We can't do it. It's simply impossible. You have to understand, you're a man of the left, you have to understand. He said, no, I don't understand. He said, you should never, we ate no stew, we were kicked out, et cetera, et cetera, lots of
things.
He said,
you should never.
He said, you should never sacrifice, as a writer, the truth for political expedience, you know? It was sort of a different message from Timmermans, but in the same area, right?
Do you remember what you thought at that moment when he said that?
I thought, I'm not having any fish stew. No, seriously.
No.
Seriously, I was in a... We had a long ideological discussion about this. So we had real trouble with one another. Because I had a similar problem with Susan Sontag, who was a dear friend. She was saying to me, how can you protest what Fidel does to certain people inside the country, artists or homosexuals, things like that, and then at the same time you sign petitions where you say you defend the fact that Cuba should not be attacked, etc. And I say, it's not contradictory at all. It's the way things are. And she said, no. And how can Gabo do this and how can Julio do that and all that? So we have all these discussions, right, with Susan about these things. So
were you wrong?
In relation to Susan, no. In relation to Grass, yes and no. No, because if you are a soldier of the revolution, then miles militis, meaning you're a militant, meaning you sacrifice yourself for the greater good, right? The moment in which you no longer become that soldier of that revolution, or you understand that you are a warrior in the heart and the mind of humanity, you become somebody else. And then in that moment, you become a free agent in some sense. It's difficult and complicated to become a free agent. In some sense, it's a story of how, as a revolutionary, I belong to a revolutionary party, etc. How I distance myself from this and therefore become able to criticize both socialism and everything else that I find, you know, in other words. But I had always been very wary of the intellectual who's not engagé. Though become engagé is not just a matter of your of becoming sort of for a cause. It's that you know, I know the people who will suffer because I am telling the truth. So I wasn't able to write about the betrayals of the Chilean Revolution, which is the story of Confidence, in some sense. It's being seen through France in 1939, but until after we had finished with Pinochet. There are things that you can do and things you can't do.
And since you mentioned engagé, yes, there is this non-encounter, this willful non-encounter
with Sartre. But that's different. That's different. The reason why I had, of course,
but he was
idealized.
He was
the giant, you know, and he.
And we also know now of his tremendous flaws.
Yes, but I think we knew those flaws at that point, some of them at least, you know. So certainly, you know, I was more of an admirer of Beauvoir than of Sartre from the point of view of the complexity of humanity, right? But Sartre was a guiding force in the 50s and 60s especially, you know, of every young writer. So I arrive in France. And Cortázar, and in fact, Jean-Pierre Fay says to me, would you like to meet Sartre, right? I had met Foucault, and my French, for reasons that I explained here, my French is not bad at all. And it wasn't bad then either, but it became really flawed and complicated when I was in France. Because I was so defeated and so complicated that I wasn't able to speak French fluently. So I had been with Foucault, and I had all these ideas that I wanted to express to him, and I was just stuttering all the time. And I explained the problem of the languages, of what it means to live in a foreign
language. Going between languages.
Between languages and not being able to speak. In other words, I had been used to speaking the way I'm speaking now, and I've always spoken like this, you know, in whole sentences and like this, in Spanish and in English. And all of a sudden I find that I'm living in French, and I'm saying things in the wrong tense, and I'm you know, and I'm stuttering, etc.
And the French will make you feel
French
that.
Oh, the French. Yeah. Right. I mean, again, we had been in places where they'd said to you, come back, please, and you can ask for a pâtisserie when you know how to pronounce it. Don't speak
and
to me.
And spell it.
And Spanish, right?
And spell it.
And spell it.
Yeah.
Spell it. I don't know what they said about spell it, probably. But I could spell it. P-A-T-I-S-S-E-E-R-I. I can do that. What I can't do is, in French, I probably could pronounce that, but you know what I mean is, pâtisserie, that's not that difficult. It's the problem isn't that. The problem is to speak. So they offer him to speak with Sartre, to meet Sartre. And I say no.
Do you regret it?
Huh?
Do you regret it now?
No, because it would have been a disaster. I mean, I have a dialogue with Sartre right now, which is eloquent. It's in English and in Spanish and a bit in French. And it's much better than anything I could have had with him personally.
What are you saying to him now?
Merde alors.
Nous sommes tous foutus. I was just thinking.
C'est ironique, mon vieux ami. Hein? Les choses sont pas ce qu'on pense qu'ils sont. That's what I would say. Things aren't the way you think they are. You know? And I said, les mouches. You had them inside, didn't you? Anyway, so lots of things. But again, I would rather have continued that conversation with him in English and in the French, my bad French, but the French in my head, than to have gone through the complicated experience of destroying, I mean, in some sense, I would have destroyed the image I had of him and me, you know?
In closing, the reasons for writing this book in particular, and I'd love you to say something after I read this about Fernando Flores. I'm going to read something that your book inspired, which is a passage from Akhmatova called Instead of a Preface. I'm sure you know it well.
Yes.
In the terrible years of Yeskov terror, I spent 17 months waiting in line outside the prison in Leningrad. One day, somebody in the crowd identified me. Standing behind me was a woman with lips blue from the cold, who had, of course, never heard me called by name before. Now she started out of the torpor common to us all and asked me in a whisper, everyone whispered there, can you describe this? And I said, I can. Then something like a smile passed fleetingly over what had once been her face.
Yes. Yes. I mean, this... So you're spared death, right? I should have died at the Moneda. I didn't. I should have died during the days after the coup. I didn't. And you begin to ask yourself, I mean, because I'm not a person who believes in God, I believe in some sort of fate, but you say, what meaning is there behind this? Or how do you turn this arbitrary, insensate act into something meaningful? How do you give it a shape? How do you turn the life that was given to you into something that was worth being spared for, right? I mean, every life is worth being spared for, but you have to find a reason of your own.
But you were spared in a very particular way.
I was spared, well, among other things, you know, I describe at greater length in Heading South, Looking North, because that's about the coup. But I was on a list in La Moneda. I was supposed to go there that day, and Fernando Flores takes my name off the list.
And he survives too.
He survives too, but he survives after spending 3 years in a concentration camp. So after being, he was the man who had taken me to La Moneda. And so I finally meet him in California, where he is building the first supercomputer at the University of Berkeley.
And you ask him why.
And I say, why was I spared? And he answers me, and by then I say in Heading South, Looking North, I had figured it out already. He says, because somebody had to tell the story. So think of this man who is the right-hand man of Allende, who instead of calling his cultural and press attaché to come to the Moneda, I mean, he's the only one he takes off the list. He says, somebody's got to live to tell the story.
So you have to become, in some sense, you're becoming, you know, as Carlo Ginzburg talks about, the last witness.
Yes, it's a terrible burden.
In a testament, in some way.
It's a testament. Now, you become il testigo.
Which literally comes from testicles. Yeah.
Which is in the Roman testimonio, the testicles. You put your testicles, only the men could testify. Women couldn't testify. It's very interesting because testimonio, the genre of testimonio in Latin America, is primarily used by women to tell their stories, like Rigoberta Menchú, right? That's a sort of archetypal one, right? But there's many more, Domitila, etc. I teach a course at Duke about testimonial literature, which I love. I find it very, very interesting, you know. So it's interesting that this is the manhood. In other words, this is the proof of who you are as a man. In other words, that you become, instead of a man, I would call it, become human. You become more human by witnessing and telling the world what you saw. If you do not tell that which you saw, if the hand of fate or God or nature or history has signaled you with being in that place in that time and with the talent, because you have to have that talent. I mean, you know, if you don't have the talent, it's useless to try to testify. I mean, you can testify, but believe me, it won't be as eloquent or elegant or lasting or searing as it should be. If you're given those instruments, you're given that experience, you are spared, and you do not tell that story, it is damnation in some sense.
You owe it.
You are the traitor. You belong in the ninth circle of hell, right? In the last circle of hell with Judas, etc. I mean, in the sense of where Dante puts those who betray. Because then you have not told the story which you saw. Now, this creates another problem, which is, it's a good way to sort of perhaps finish. Do we have time for Q&A?
We do. Yes.
Okay. So this creates a problem, which is that you are pigeonholed as only the witness. And it turns out that you're more than just the witness. Again, what witness writes the story of the copy editor who retrieves all the books that about the nun, right? So the witness to what is that? You have many people here who are not necessarily witnesses because they weren't chosen. They weren't selected by fate. They didn't live those things. And I was unfortunate enough to have these things happen to me and fortunate enough to have the means and resources in my own spirit to respond to that and to give shape to that and to give a certain endurance to that, perduración, in other words, that it endures, right?
Le dur désir de durer, you know.
Yes, durer, right, yeah. Right. But if you think of it, it also creates the sense that, oh, all he does is this, right? So he writes Death and the Maiden, he can't write a comedy. So he writes the story of exile, but he can't tell the story of the Nanny and the Iceberg, where an iceberg that is brought to, that Chile's taking a piece of Antarctica and taking it to Sevilla, which is an act of absolute lunacy, right? And there's a young man who wants to, who hasn't ever made love, and his father's the detective who's got to stop them from blowing up the iceberg, etc. So where does that fit? What I mean is, like Whitman, you know, there are many of us inside this. There are many of us inside all of us. And one of the things that characterizes me as a writer is that I cover every genre. I do everything that's possible. I'm working on opera now. I'm working on a new play. I'm doing all these stories that I've been writing all summer. I do memoirs. I do this. I do all these. I did a musical, right, with all the with a character like Bloody Mary out of South Pacific. So there seems to be, I don't know, a sense, especially in the marketing of the world, that you have to do your thing. And this is what you do. Now, this typically is what I do. I mean, according to the image of Ariel Dorfman. But it pains me somewhat that people are not generous enough to understand that we are many different people.
We contain multitudes.
Yeah. Everybody contains multitudes, right? Now, I contain perhaps super multitudes because I have all these things coming
out.
Well,
you have a voracious appetite.
I do. I do indeed, as you will find out at dinner.
In truly in closing, I would like us to listen to a poem, actually, wrote.
When they tell you I'm not a prisoner, don't believe them. They'll have to admit it someday. When they tell you they released me, don't believe them. They'll have to admit it's a lie someday. When they tell you I betrayed the party, don't believe them. They'll have to admit I was loyal someday. When they tell you I'm in France, don't believe them. Don't believe them when they show you my false ID, don't believe them. Don't believe them when they show you the photo of my body, don't believe them. Don't believe them when they tell you the moon is the moon, if they tell you the moon is the moon. That this is my voice on tape, this is my signature on a confession. If they say a tree is a tree, don't believe them. Don't believe anything they tell you, anything they swear to, anything they show you, don't believe them. And finally, when that day comes, when they ask you to identify the body, and you see me, and a voice says, we killed him. The poor bastard died. He's dead. When they tell you that I am completely, absolutely, definitely dead, don't believe them. Don't believe them. Don't believe them.
Oh. Well, that's my dear friend Harold Pinter. And that's his favorite poem, according to him. He read it also at Peggy Ashcroft's funeral in Westminster Abbey. And of course, everybody tells me that Harold is completely, absolutely, definitely dead. And of course, they're absolutely, definitely, completely wrong. We'll all be dead, but they're absolutely wrong about this. We are not, right? Here's a typical example of this, you know. I mean, Pinter appears just vaguely in this book because the anecdotes about him didn't fit in it. You know, a book has its own logic. You can't... I admire people who are able to write 10,000 pages about their life, right? Which is almost as long as their life as the joke that we just made. But there's a moment in which you lose a sense of it. And there are other places. So I've just written something which will appear in the Daily Telegraph in England, because it turns out that they're doing the revival of Death and the Maiden in London, in the West End, with Tandy Newton in the role of Paulina. And they're naming the comedy theater where they just did Betrayal by Pinter with Kristin Scott Thomas, the Pinter Theater.
I heard about that.
And the Pinter Theater is opening with Death and the Maiden, which is dedicated to him.
And you started your career by writing about
Pinter. I wrote
Pinter.
About Pinter, L'Absurdo in Tre Quattro Paresi, when my first book was about Harold Pinter.
So it's come full circle.
Come full circle. And so the story of my relationship with Pinter, I wrote about Pinter when Harold died, and I wrote about him before as well, but I never told the story of our encounters and the relationship with Death and the Maiden. Without him, it wouldn't exist, but that's another story. It'll probably appear here in some guise. You know, but it's basically for the opening there, and so there's a story there, which is the story of Harold and my relationship and our friendship, which didn't fit in this book. It should have been in the book, but it can't be in the book because I wouldn't have been able to create out of that knot something that resonated for the whole of the book. I would have had to have left something else out. Right?
Though the poem itself in some way underlines the book. Don't believe it, don't believe it. The book begins in a way under the umbrella of Mark Twain in some way.
But the poem is also in the book. Yeah. That poem, that very poem that Harold chose when he did this for the Madre de la Plaza de Mayo. He did it for a video that they were doing and went into
which
YouTube.
Is incredible, incidentally. You should all watch it.
Yes, but I didn't tell him about this, by the way. He's just done incredible research and gone viral sending it to everybody. But so Harold loved this.
I couldn't keep myself from doing that.
Thank you, because I feel very good about having written. These are the poems that I began writing after I went through 2.5 years of writer's block after the coup, but that's a story we can't even go into at this point because that's really, really long. So, but I was saying that it's strange how certain stories that happen to you can not be told. In other words, there's a shape that you have to respect of the book itself. The book has got demands. The book makes demands on you. And woe to the author who does not listen to his own book or her own book, right? Because the book will take revenge upon you.
The book also begins with a death foretold, your own.
Exactly.
And under the guise of the wonderful story of Mark Twain.
Correct.
Saying that the notices of his death
it
have
begins
been
with that, which is a real story, right? So it begins with a quote of a writer, an American writer speaking that I used to speak about the fact that they found me with my slow thread in Chile, and that somebody called me on the phone and said, "Would you like to comment on the fact that you've just been found dead in Chile?" And I said, "The news of my death have been greatly exaggerated. I've been waiting for years to tell this one. You know, which is, I thought it was terrific." But then, of course, it turned out not to be that funny, right? Because somebody had died, really. And the other thing is, were they sending me a message? Were they saying, don't go back to Chile because you will be killed if you go there? So it's a struggle against death. But I think we should leave that at this point and listen to some questions.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two mics in each direction. It would be best if you came up to the mics. Don't be shy.
I'm not shy at all.
I'm interested if you could expand a tiny bit more on where maybe the writer's mission to expose the truth or to make the truth more alive to people, where that diverges from the revolution,
uh-huh.
at times, and how you navigate that, because I'm sure it's
uh-huh.
it's pretty opaque a lot of the time.
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to say that I don't think that the writer has a mission, in the sense that one of the things that I learned that come through the book is I would have said when I left Chile that there was something that writers should do. They should be engaged socially, even if I like writers who weren't, but I'm sort of saying this is my ideal. And for the last perhaps for the last 25 years or so, sometime just before the dictatorship fell, I began to, no, perhaps more than that, much more than that, I began sort of to say, you know what, this is how I write, and I don't consider this to be a model for anybody or a precept for anybody. Because the moment in which you say, this is how you should write, you're sort of imposing something, okay? So I will answer only for myself and not for writing in general. I always make this, because there used to be a time when I would say, the intellectual should do this thing. You know, perhaps yes and perhaps no. Perhaps there are certain intellectuals who should, and certain intellectuals should write beautiful sonnets, I'm just saying what I had to do and what I couldn't avoid doing. So when you are consumed by a need for justice, as I am and was, and when the world is organized in an unfair manner, and you wish to change that world, what happens very often when you come from countries such as mine, though it happens also in countries such as this one in times such as Steinbeck's time, right? Or just before the Civil War. Or in the 1960s, right? When certain writers, there is such effervescence that certain writers who would not normally be engaged, let's say, right? It's not that they don't care about the polytests, about the political thing. It's simply that that's not their main thing to do, right? They become, or after 9/11, several writers go, and some of them write things that are not quite good. I mean, there's the book that I think Updike wrote about the 9/11,
Terrorist.
Which is a terrible book. He writes wonderfully, but this is a terrible book. He understands nothing of these things, right? So what I'm trying to say, but they feel compelled at certain moments to do that. Now, I was brought up very politically from very, very young, and I had a sense of this injustice very, very strongly. That didn't mean that that's the only thing I was writing. I was writing all sorts of things. As I said, I contained multitudes, even probably I was 1 day old, right? So I became so engaged. And I can remember the day when I became a member of a political party, which is the day in which René Schneider was assassinated by a CIA-induced plot in Chile to overthrow Allende before he had even became president, to stop him from becoming president, right? And I called my dear friend Antonio Skarmeta, who at that point was a militant of a MAPU, the MAPU party, and I said, listen, I want to become a militant. In other words, I want to become a member of the party because I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. If you have to defend the revolution, where do I go? Only if you become part of an organization, right? Now, these organizations, even if they're democratic, and most Marxist parties are not, almost inevitably because they live in clandestinity and they live in with a pyramidal structure like that, right? In which certain enlightened individuals, then they repeat that when they take power and then it's a disaster happens, right? But that's a different story. So you have to have an organization, right? In other words, revolutionary parties are born in strife, in repression, out of torture, out of disaster. And therefore, they are these closed, illuminated, groups of people, right? Of which there are, by the way, if you look at what happened in the 20s and the 30s, you'll see that there's practically not one great writer in the world who was not a communist, right? Or a fellow communist, right? As a fellow traveler in some way. If you look at Dos Passos, they all were part of that, right? The movement. So the question is, how do you become Orwell, right? So how do you become the critical consciousness in those situations? And some of us do and some of us don't. And in my case, I always was in some sense. Because when I wrote during the Chilean Revolution, the book that I wrote, Moros en la Costa, was Hard Rain, is a book which is full of disasters. It anticipates the destruction that's coming in Chile, but I didn't want to write about that. So I suppressed it in some sense. As I grew to understand that my role was to be somebody who would tell the truth no matter what, I began writing in some sense in a different way. And these books, in some sense, the book in English is not so transgressive as Heading South, Looking North is also. But in Spanish, these books are tremendously transgressive. Nobody ever says in the Spanish literature that they were scared. Because you have your honor, right? So I was dying of fear. So telling that story, I don't know what they're going to think of the fact that I speak about the fact that I betrayed people, that I did terrible things, that I did things that I'm ashamed of, that I was ashamed of then and I'm still ashamed of, things I'm not proud of. But if I don't tell that story, then all the rest is false. If you're only telling the good of things, right? Then you're not helping anybody to understand themselves better as a human being. And you're not helping any possible change that may occur in the world. Again, because the utopia doesn't happen only out there, it happens in here as well. So that back and forth is something that I've been working on, let's say. And if you look at my plays and my novels, I mean, you know, Death on the Maiden itself, the only person who commits violence is the victim there. This is a very complicated thing for me to do. Instead of showing the bad, evil man who's torturing this wonderful woman, it's this wonderful woman who's torturing somebody who isn't even sure if he's really the guy who did this thing to her, right? So what do? I bring up and I stir up the problems. Because by doing that, I'm saying, listen, when you have something like this in your life, like a dictatorship like this, nobody ends up pure. We're all contaminated. Unless we accept that, not that I have a little Pinochet inside, I don't. I will never torture. At least I think I never will. You know, I'm pretty sure I won't. But unless we realize the enormous complexity of what we're in as a solution in the world, we'll never get out of this. And that's one of the things, by the way, which just to bring it today, makes me despair what's happening in this country. Because we have a president who is an enormously complex thinker, and he has been reduced to fighting a battle against the oversimplification and falsification of everything. I'm not saying that he couldn't have done better, right? But I'm just trying to say the strange thing is that we find ourselves in a situation where to be intellectual, it's been like that in America for a long time, anti-intellectualism is something, you know, was written about at great length, is a sin. This library is a sin against America, or at least what is middle America. I can't believe it.
We will quote you.
Yes. Save the libraries, right?
It's funny you should mention Orwell.
Libraries first, then it's the funny, children, then the women.
It's funny you should mention, you know...
Don't quote me, please.
It's funny you should mention Orwell because I was just rereading, upon reading your yes. book, Why I Write.
Yes.
And you remember the four categories.
Yes.
He says sheer egoism, aesthetic enthusiasm, historical impulse, or political purpose.
Yes.
What is yours?
All of those and some more, you know. Scatabitha would add to find pretty women.
On that note, thank you very much.